Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spingola Zone. It is Tuesday, January 21st, 2014. This is Deanna Spingola. This weekly program is sponsored by the American Free Press, whose website is AmericanFreePress.net. I am a subscriber to the American Free Press and highly recommend a subscription to what is probably the very last free speech newspaper in America. I also wish to commend the wonderful historical journal, the Barnes Review, whose website is BarnesReview.org, that's spelled B-A-R-N-E-S, BarnesReview.org. Please visit both websites, support the efforts of the wonderful people who make such a great effort to report accurate history and contemporary events. I will take questions, email questions at comment@Spingola.com, or you can visit the chat room, which is Spingola.chatango.com. My websites are Spingola.com and SpingolaSpeaks.info. For this program, I highly recommend that you open the notes section. That website is Spingola.com/SandyHook.html. Again, Spingola.com/SandyHook.html. All righty. A very wise friend of mine recently said, and I quote, "Listen to everyone, read everything, believe nothing unless you can prove it in your own research," unquote. Truth is not a popularity contest or something to vote on. So what if others have previously produced their views on this event, whether it's Sandy Hook or whatever? Does that mean case closed? No other views are allowed? I do not have a monopoly on the truth, and I don't think that anyone else does either. I was not present at Sandy Hook. Anyone who was there has no idea what happened. We are all susceptible and vulnerable to what we read and see in the media, including the Internet. People should be open-minded enough to review all the possibilities, do their own research, and then draw some conclusions. There are two ways of doing research, haphazard or systematic. Researchers who are systematic in their efforts look at all of the records available. Essentially, there are two kinds of sources. Number one, primary or original, and number two, secondary or compiled. In each category, there are primary sources. In each category, there are the very best sources, the primary sources, and these are records that are created at the time of the event. Secondary sources are typically compiled sources, which are frequently based on hearsay or circumstantial evidence. Every researcher should cite their sources so that others might verify or access the very same information. Without verifiable sources, people may regard that information, the information presented, as hearsay or merely an opinion, which, like a smile, everyone has. Currently, one of the biggest collections of secondary sources include compiled data on the Internet, some of which is presented by unknown entities and some by people who identify themselves. Big pharma and the medical industry kills about 900,000 people a year through their vaccines, toxic medications, fluoride, aspartame, and drives hundreds of others to engage in aggressive behavior against others. 23 active members of the military or recent veterans commit suicide each and every day, while 280,000 infants under the age of 12 months receive antipsychotic drugs based on their doctor's recommendation and prescription. Without the financial contributions of the pharmaceutical industry, an individual will not be elected to a political office. Therefore, One might conclude that the pharmaceutical industry controls the political dialogue and the actions in this country and will do whatever it takes to conceal the negative, deadly consequences of their toxic chemicals. Inasmuch as the government invests in and is largely controlled by those corporate interests, the government is going to take countermeasures to control or obfuscate the truth, especially in the so-called truth movement. They do this by using the Delphi technique, which was developed by the RAND Corporation for the U.S. Department of Defense back in the 1950s. It is a very valuable psychological weapon to manipulate any group, like the skeptical and very susceptible people in the alternative media who anticipate conspiracy or corruption at every turn. If the government was going to implement a counterintelligence operation, it would be within the so-called truth movement. In my first program about Sandy Hook on Wednesday, January 15th, on RBN, I said that I expected that some people would ridicule me for my remarks. I focused on the possibility that the shooter in the numerous school and other public sites were influenced by psychiatric drugs, something that government officials would want to conceal. I want to emphasize that I do not accept 100% of the official version of Sandy Hook. On my previous program regarding this event, I referred to a program, a radio program, that I conducted on Thursday, December 19, 2013, in which I discussed Beverly K. Ekman's book, How to Counter Group Manipulation Tactics. On the front cover, there is a group of 23 people sitting at a round table. Then there is the facilitator, or operative, who is probably five times the size of the targets, the group of people. In a text bubble, he is saying, and I quote, "Even a child could see," unquote. We in the truth movement are a group of people. Each of us has that herd mentality, whether we wish to admit it or not. Do not want to counter a popular stance because we do not want to be ridiculed. The popular stance in this case comprises the ideas and theories that emerged immediately after the events at Sandy Hook. Over the weekend, I rewatched the movie A Face in the Crowd, which was made in 1957, starring Andy Griffith. And this film demonstrates how a person might manipulate crowds of people. Let me share some more ideas from Ekman's book as a frame of reference. Again, the name of the book is How to Counter Group Manipulation Tactics. And I've kind of reformatted these ideas to meet the circumstances that I'm talking about. Have you ever had the demoralizing experience of being labeled a divisive troublemaker as soon as you question a popular belief or present an alternative view? Unfortunately, being seen as uncooperative is not socially acceptable these days. Be it in the workplace, a chat room, an internet forum, or on a radio program, team spirit is valued above all else, including the truth. No one is supposed to offer an alternative opinion that opposes the popularly accepted theories. The validity of your argument or concern is of little account if it flies in the face of team spirit. It is akin to trying to introduce scientific evidence that the Holocaust did not occur at a crowd-filled synagogue. Most people, no matter how intelligent or astute, do not realize they are dealing with well-trained provocateurs the minute they engage with such people on the Internet. Provocateurs, also called agents of change, professional agitators, and facilitators, may include teachers, administrators, academics, or other professionals. They are often paid by special interests, such as the pharmaceutical industry or a government agency, sorry to be redundant here, to sell you an idea or a theory in order to misdirect a real investigation. These might be ideas that you would disapprove of if they were presented on their own merits. To have your view heard and taken seriously, you must know first how to recognize psychological manipulation, and second, be able to work around it. You must be able to deframe the debate, take it away from your adversary, and argue the issue in question on your terms, not on your opponent's terms. To do that requires that you master the principles of argument and be able to apply them in a group setting like the internet, which is a group. And this is a very interesting statement. It is easier to control a group than it is to control a single individual. That may sound strange, but it is actually the reason behind attempts to collectivize people. Unethical facilitators, the ones with an ulterior motive, will always try to maneuver you into a group setting. This is your first giveaway as to the kind of person you are dealing with, a change agent, agitator, or a provocateur. The group is used by the provocateur to help combat any person viewed as adversarial, using isolation, ridicule, ostracism, and finally by overwhelming the adversary through mob censure. Most average people, including well-educated independent thinkers, don't recognize these tactics. Most of us are caught up in the erroneous notion that if we just engage the opposition in meaningful, preferably one-on-one discussion or debate, logic will triumph. This is true only if all the individuals are honestly seeking, honestly debating an issue as equals. It is not true if the debate is dishonest. If a provocateur can generate a mob mentality and get it to work, control of the agenda is typically assured. And rule number one is you never let the other fellow control the debate or agenda. And they have certain ways of doing that. The ideas, or let's see, the key to remember is whether you are talking about a classroom full of students or a committee full of adults, the provocateur gets the group to do the dirty work. The whole process is super authoritarian under the pretense of not being dictatorial at all. The mob mentality is achieved by creating what is known in the vernacular of experts as a psychologically controlled environment. And that is exactly what we have on the internet. You will want to disrupt, or better yet, preempt any establishment of a psychologically controlled environment. In this case, it is already too late. Failing that, you will need to understand the strategies and techniques that a provocateur uses to ensure the outcome he or she wants, that you can counter those techniques as you go and get others in the group to help you, whether they understand what is going on or not. In other words, you have to beat the provocateur at his or her own game. To summarize, the following three-part formula governs your ability to recognize a provocateur's consensus-building techniques. And remember, it is easier to control a group than to control a single individual. And the internet, the so-called truth movement, is a group. It can be controlled. It can be manipulated. The opponent should never be permitted to control the debate or the agenda. You need to watch out for the psychologically controlled environment. This formula is the basis of psych war. The actual principles of psych war which may first appear to be to only apply to physical wars, but no. When you're talking about a battle, including a psychological battle, you need to consider all these stipulations. First, however, you need to examine the concept of strategic battle. Strategy involves general rules that govern tactical maneuvers. America's traditionalists, unfortunately, have an extremely weak sense of strategy, owing most likely to the fact that our values revolve around themes like kindness, consideration, and tact. But our foes are bullies. And bullies always have the advantage because they don't adhere to such values. This does not mean traditionalists should abandon kindness and consideration. The tactical premises, the battle strategies behind psych war go back a long way to an ancient Chinese text entitled The Art of War by Sun Tzu. The first task, then, of professional agitation is to create a psychologically controlled environment. This makes it easier for one side to frame the debate and keep the opposition from doing so. A psychologically controlled environment provides a platform from which to operate and prevents anyone else from injecting an alternative viewpoint or redirecting the discussion. The consensus generated from such a forum typically is taken to a legislator or presented in a group, such as the Internet. This sets up a kind of mass neuroses, a kind of permanent paranoia, because people like you may know the consensus isn't true. Yet the lie is presented by reputable sources, and they are believed. This leads to a psychological condition known to professionals as cognitive dissonance, meaning an irreconcilable conflict. As people become uncomfortable, they vacillate, they lose their frame of reference, become alienated, and an alienated electorate, or particularly the backbone of society or the backbone of the Internet, the backbone of the truth movement, is a tremendous boon to a provocateur because it effectively gets the primary resistance out of the way. So it's very important if you're a paid provocateur to state your claims immediately. Another take on this game, if you will, has been for the provocateur to whip dissenters into a teeth-clenching frenzy of anger until they become so outraged, enraged, and frustrated that they start lashing out in all directions, unfocused and in disarray. Understand that counterculture activists are not interested in any exchange of ideas. They want to drive the opposition insane, cause them to act irrationally, and they want, most of all, to get us mad so that we sputter over our words, slam the door, maybe even start name-calling. So what is really important to know is that professional agitators, change agents, and facilitators, all of whom in reality are trained to provoke you, to undermine you, to alienate you, and to isolate you. And if they can make you angry enough, you might even be charged with some trumped-up offense, or at least lose credibility. And this is not what we want. Most of us in the truth movement are looking for the truth. And as I said before, we have no monopoly. No one person has a monopoly on the truth. All righty, let's see. Page here. Now there are some things. It's important to understand that neutralizing consensus building techniques. People should not be name calling, using stereotypes, using labels. We need to discern the difference between a debate, a discussion, and a hostile setting. We need to recognize the difference between groupthink and peer social pressure. And remember that social pressure is used as a tool to ostracize independent thinkers. And they do that with mob censure. Okay, let's talk about consensus building. The dictionary definition of consensus is group solidarity in sentiment and belief and or general agreement. Unanimity, on the other hand, is defined as collective opinion. In other words, everybody is going to think the same thing. And increasingly, people are hearing the term consensus when what our opponents want in reality is uniform thinking. They want everybody to be thinking the exact same thing. Nobody will have a different opinion. Nobody is allowed to have a different opinion, or else they will be ostracized, or people will just ignore them or call them names or try to destroy their credibility. Consensus does not mean compromise. A consensus is essentially a collective opinion that doesn't reflect any one individual opinion. The collective good is viewed as more important than the individual good. That, in essence, is a Marxist mindset. And consensus then no longer falls into the category of compromise. Consensus is a stronger term because the pro and con viewpoints in a collectivist mindset no longer exist. The rightness or wrongness, the pro or the con of the original viewpoints is not at issue. The goal is to produce a new ideal, a new opinion or value that will be universally supported or at least appears to be supported by everyone. And that's what's important. Appears to be. What appears to be is not always what is accurate. So the purpose of various consensus strategies is to preserve the illusion that there is just one community, one decision making, and it means something far different than working out a compromise. When a professional provocateur, for example, is trying to gain acceptance of a, and they want to have you pretend or to have you, to get you involved so that when you start thinking the way that they think, what they will try to do is they will get other researchers to contribute to a particular collection of information, of ideas, in order for you to think that everything that has been in this collection is also your idea and that you accept it. The Delphi technique is just one unethical method of achieving consensus on controversial topics. A well-trained professional agitator will deliberately pit one faction against another to make the favored side appear sensible and any opposing view ridiculous. The setting or type of group in which the technique is used is immaterial. The logic behind its success is that most groups tend to share a particular knowledge base and display a certain set of identifiable characteristics. The provocateur wants to locate those smaller factions within the larger group. Provocateurs or agitators, who often call themselves facilitators because it sounds neutral, but what these pros really do is to work the group over to ensure a predetermined outcome, which they call a consensus. If the discussion is facilitated properly, all participants will emerge believing the decision reached was their own idea. Only later will some realize that they were duped. The provocateur will first try to become an accepted member of the larger group, but later will turn factions of the group against its own members. Suddenly, the amiable facilitator will become the devil's advocate. Using the divide and conquer principle, he or she pits one faction against the other, making those whose views that are not desired appear ridiculous, unknowledgeable, ridiculous, or dogmatic. She or he deftly augments tension deliberately exacerbates disagreements, and if the stage is set properly during the initial phase, a well-trained provocateur will be able to predict the reactions of most members of a group. Individuals in opposition to a desired theory or project or program will find themselves shut out. The Delphi technique works. It is effective with parents, teachers, children, and on the internet. The targets rarely, if ever, realize that they have been manipulated. If they do suspect what is happening, they generally do not know how to shut down that process. This is very interesting stuff, and I think everybody should know about this because it's we all are manipulated by other people, whether we like it or not. It just happens. The only opposing getting back to the book. The only opposing arguments permitted will be those that the provocateur deems helpful in escalating tensions later. So if you have an opposing view and you know this is not the preferred view, don't be taken in when the facilitator acknowledges your ideas. Remain on guard. The provocateur, acting as a moderator, guides the discussion, whether it's on the internet or wherever, in a chat room, in a forum, on a radio program, so that it doesn't get away from him or her. This means that this facilitator operative frames the debate and is careful not to let it go. And we're going to talk about framing the debate real soon. Soon, some participants begin to adopt the preferred view of the event or the preferred view of whatever the facilitator is working you towards, as if it were his or her own. And they will be manipulated into pressuring the entire group into accepting the proposition. Why the Delphi technique works. Consensus strategies like Delphi utilize Karl Marx's theory of alienation, which states that folks will do just about anything to avoid being ostracized, ridiculed, or to otherwise lose face. What happens is that somewhere in the consensus-building process, there is a switch that confuses and freezes normal responses. Aware that something is going wrong and unable to explain, define, or confront it, you find yourself tongue-tied. Linguistics professor Dean Gotcher, the director of the Institute of Authority Research, explains that there appears to be a trigger mechanism that cuts off one's awareness of impending danger and suppresses the ability to resist, resulting in indecision and eventually capitulation. The key to resistance, especially in highly charged, well-organized situations, lies in controlling the environment of thought. An environment of thought means determining what a group of individuals is going to think about and for how long. So, whoever controls the debate or agenda controls the substance of what is going on. And they initially do this by framing the agenda. What do I mean by framing the agenda or framing the argument? It usually happens that when an event happens, the first people out of the door with some information are in the process of framing the argument. So on Thursday, now Sandy Hook happened on December 14th, 2012. On Thursday, December 20th, 2012, one researcher said, and I quote, "At this point, it is safe to say that the official narrative of the Sandy Hook shooting is fraudulent and a major cover-up and PSYOP is underway," unquote. Now, that's pretty blatant. That's pretty arrogant to come out 6 days later and make that kind of a statement. So they're setting up the environment. On December 21st, 2012, Jay Johnson, who has a website called Sandy Hook Hoax, said, and I quote, "I think the idea of a young man shooting kids for no reason is a black op type psychological operation and did not happen, and is therefore a hoax," unquote. Many people claim that Robbie Parker was a very bad actor playing the role of the father of Emily Parker, a six-year-old girl killed at Sandy Hook Elementary. If he were an actor, he would not have needed a cue card. People allege that the girl on Obama's lap is Emily. Sometimes siblings have identical outfits or they are passed down to them from older siblings. Siblings often look alike because they are, in fact, siblings. Robbie Parker is a physician assistant, originally from Ogden, Utah, who relocated to Connecticut after living in Oregon, New Mexico. Connecticut's Department of Public Health has a licensing verification website. Excuse me, getting a frog in my throat. Excuse me. Connecticut's Department of Public Health has a licensing verification website which allows people to search the credentials of any service provider who is required by the state to be licensed. And if you go to that website, you will find his record. According to the Connecticut e-licensing website, Parker has a license to practice as a certified physician assistant in that state, although his license has a New York or a New Mexico address. Officials issued his license on 9/28/11, September 28, 2011. A physician assistant cannot be certified. He cannot be a PA-C unless or until he or she has passed the NCCPA-administered Physician Assistant National Certifying Exam, which allows the individual to practice in all 50 states. There is a New Mexico address on his Connecticut license because he lived in New Mexico at the time prior to finding a position in Newtown. And I do have a copy or an image on the website that I mentioned before, spingola.com/sandyhook.html, which gives all of the details, the information, this license. Robbie Parker is not an actor hired by the government, earning a degree as a certified physician assistant requires passing a rigorous certification exam in addition to obtaining 100 continuing medical education hours and re-registering their certificate with the NCCPA every 2 years. So, what actor is going to go through all of that in order to get a certificate so that they can somehow be at a place, be in Sandy Hook, be in Newtown, to participate in this event? One of the first videos to emerge after the event was the Sandy Hook shooting, fully exposed, a 30-minute video that an entity using the name Think Outside the TV published on January 7, 2013. Now, it took time to create this video, and the maker states that Idaho Picker, Max Malone, and One Truth for Life contributed. Well, who are these people? He also used some video from Alex Jones' InfoWars site. It has had approximately 11.5 million views. Brian Alexander also posted this on his website on January 16, 2013. Now, on Wednesday, January 30th, 2013, about 6 weeks after Sandy Hook, two researchers, Dennis Cimino, several ideas. Now, this is about 6 weeks after, and this is what we call framing the debate. These are the ideas. Number one, no children were killed. Number two, that Sandy Hook was not an operating school. Number three, they introduced the idea that Adam Lanza died the day before by using an image of a purported Social Security death index record. Number four, they introduced the idea that Adam Lanza did not even exist. Number five, they talked about Mike Powers, who appeared on Joyce Riley's on January 16, 2013, just over a month after Sandy Hook, which said that logistically, Lanza could not have carried off the shooting. Now, this reminds me that Joyce Riley, she was married to Dave Von Kleist, who was one of the first people who created a movie, a video, about 9/11. And that was 9/11 in Plain Sight, Director's Cut, which came out in 2004. Again, framing the debate. He also did another documentary called 9/11 Ripple Effect in 2007. Dave and Joyce divorced in 2009. Dave's father, just for interest, was a colonel in the U.S. Air Force. Dave has since kind of disappeared. Number six, they introduced the idea of satanic worship, suggesting that even an infant participated in the way that she sucked on her fingers. And this was referring to a family photo of the children, and they implied that Robbie Parker was showing three fingers. Somehow this is a satanic way of holding your hands, and that the baby, the youngest child, made a satanic symbol by the way that she sucked on her fingers. Okay, number seven, they introduced the idea that it was all about gun control and the disarming of the public, ignoring the influence of psychiatric drugs in every public shooting. Number eight, they reminded us that the government has FEMA camps and 1.5 billion rounds of 40 caliber hollow point ammunition. I'm not sure how that relates. Number nine, that the Mossad may have been behind Sandy Hook. Number 10, they introduced the idea that other shootings were also hoaxes staged by the government. Number 11, they introduced the idea that actors were used at Sandy Hook. They introduced the idea that Sandy Hook was a drill. Number 13, they introduced the idea that officials were smirking at Aurora, which would seemingly be applicable to Sandy Hook. Number 14, they introduced the idea of premeditation. Looks like we have an email question. So these are some interesting ideas that they got out right away. I mean, within 6 weeks, that's pretty fast work to figure all these things out. Now, some individuals suggest that Adam P. Lanza did not actually exist, which, of course, is an opinion if one does not conduct proper research. To determine if Adam Lanza existed, one should check primary sources. In this case, one would check for a birth record, a Social Security record, school records, census records, and, of course, we would not find him in the latest publicly released census record, which is 1940, but if one knows the address, which of course we do, if one knows the address, then we could check the 2010 census record and we would find him there. We would also check medical and dental records and a death record. Now, and of course, additionally, eyewitness accounts from people who interacted with Adam P. Lanza could substantiate the primary source evidence. And one of those people was Ryan Kraft, a neighbor who babysat Adam about 10 years ago and, I quote, noticed some unusual behavior from the boy, unquote. Kraft, a former student at Sandy Hook, said, and I quote, when I put him to bed early or stopped doing something, he would be really unhappy about it and throw a tantrum in a way that a younger child I would normally expect to behave. Unquote, Kraft said. Adam always struck me as a really introverted kid. He was really quiet, and whenever we were doing something whether he was building Legos or playing video games. He was really focused on it, like he was in his own world, unquote. A neighbor of Delancey said that he was on meds, that he was on SSRIs, and those, of course, cause violence in some people. Now, we know that Ryan J. Lanza, who was 4 years older than Adam, appeared to be living in the home at 36 Yogananda Street in Sandy Hook in 2010. And that is from the voter's records. His birth date is on April 10th. Now, getting back to the idea that Adam Lanza died the day before Sandy Hook, and what the people who made that claim, they used the SSDI, which is the Social Security Death Index. Now, when I look at the Social Security Death Index, which you can do very easily, I found that he died the very day that they said he did, on the 14th. And so they have introduced the idea that the Social Security Death Index is a legitimate resource to look at, in as much as they have used it, or at least they said they used it. But in as much as the date that I found in the index and the date that they say he died is different, I have to question which index they were using. Now, getting back to Ryan J. Lanza, who is 4 years older than Adam. The police questioned Ryan Lanza, who told the police that he had not spoken to his brother for more than a year. When they asked him why, Ryan said that Adam is sick and doesn't talk to anyone. They then asked, "Do you have any idea why he did this?" And Ryan responded, and I quote, "No, I don't know him anymore." Now, Nancy Lanza was very, very devoted to obtaining mental health services for Adam. And, excuse me. And it seems bizarre that the state police report failed to provide information about the last 5 years about his mental health records. And in light of the article dated June 30th, 2013 by the Hartford Courant, stating that the paper had access to Lanza's medical records from birth to age 18, it becomes kind of curious that the official state police report failed to make these records public. And of course, of course, these records should be made public unless there's something that they're attempting to hide. let me just get a drink of water. I'm so sorry about this. Gosh, I guess it was my other. I've been on the, this is my third hour on the radio. Excuse me, just a second. We will take a break at the top of the hour for about 5 minutes. So the officials would not make these records public. Connecticut Assistant Attorney General Patrick B. Guanzi, during a Freedom of Information hearing on this matter, stated that releasing this information could cause a lot of people to stop taking their medications. And of course, and again, he said a few days later that obviously it is a credible indication that Adam Lanza was taking a psychiatric medication around the time of the shootings. However, the state of Connecticut will not release the information because it might induce large numbers of people to stop taking antidepressants. All righty, let's just talk a bit about Cass Sunstein. person.
You know, Deanna, this is Chris Petherick. Hey, Dave's not here since I'm engineering the show. I figured I'd give you a little break to take a second here, get a drink of water or something. And I was just going to reiterate, you know, talk about what you had been saying is that about so much of the claims made about. I've been listening intently with what you've been talking about before because we've, you know, at the newspaper, I mean, we have come under such pressure to publicize a lot of these, you know, a lot of the claims made about Sandy Hook and about what happened, what didn't happen, all of this. And so much the trouble that we've had is that so much of this relied on the people throwing out their opinions, like you stated, and then expecting us to disprove their opinions rather than they're having to prove their opinions and make them fact, you know, and you've really touched them. I mean, so much of this is really what you've touched on is summed up by that statement. That is, we live in a world today where we can say just about anything. I could say, you know, a teapot is circling around Jupiter. And then I would say, okay, Deanna, it's up to you to disprove my theory about that rather than for me to have to prove that. So these outlandish claims that people have been making about, you know, the weapons used and this person didn't exist and the death of this person and so on and so on, the people call us up, and even some of our own writers do that and expect us to then go and try to disprove these claims. And it takes a tremendous amount of time to be able to do this. So I appreciate the fact that you've really obviously done a ton of legwork on this and gone through it and put that out there. So this is wonderful.
Well,
you know,
actually, I'm glad you that you excuse me. Keep talking. Let me get a drink.
Sure. Yeah, no, we're having this debate coming up on Thursday between Dr. Jim Fetzer and one of our writers, Keith Johnson, who's worked in law enforcement as a former private investigator. Anybody who reads the paper or reads the website would certainly know Keith Johnson's writings. He's based in facts, and he writes in facts, and he's a great researcher. And since he's you know, was involved in law enforcement, he's aware of all the tools that are out there to be able to get to the bottom of the story, and he's fearless about these things. And so it'll be very interesting to see. I'm very much looking forward to this debate because I've read much of what, you know, Jim Fetzer and a lot of these other individuals have put out, the materials they put out, and it's made our lives very difficult because we don't publish material like that. We don't write like that. You know, when we report on something, we have to have some foundation. In fact, because people take, you know, what we say as we're speaking from authority and that we're knowledgeable about this and we've done the research. And it's just a disturbing trend that I've seen in our universe where people now are just spouting out using, you know, blogs and websites where you don't even know the person. That I saw one with, you know, I don't want to go off track, but with the Boston Marathon, which was circulated all over the place by a person claiming to be an EMT, yet he couldn't even be bothered to tell us what his name was. And so we would never use that as a source, but now people rely on that. So anyways, I didn't mean to interrupt you here. I just wanted to give you a little break here.
Oh, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you did. I was having such a time with my, I'm still having it here. Well, excuse me. And that is a problem. And it polarizes a group, and that was exactly what Cass Sunstein and his partner in writing, Adrian Vermeil, and they talked about, they wrote papers talking about the infiltration of agents or their allies into the Internet. And he said, however, our main policy idea is that government should engage in cognitive infiltration of the groups that produce conspiracy theories, which involves a combination of the following. Government might itself engage in counter-speech, marshaling arguments to discredit conspiracy theories. Government might formally hire credible private parties to engage in counter-speech. Or, number three, government might engage in informal communication with such parties, encouraging them to help. Now, it's very interesting. We don't want to say, oh, this person's an infiltrator, a facilitator, or a change agent. But you have to look at what people are doing, and you have to look at who's framing the debate, who got out there early and laid the seemingly wonderful groundwork that everybody was supposed to believe. And gosh, if they didn't believe it, then what kind of person were they? And in one of the websites, there was 10 questions, 10 points. And I want to go over those points. And let's see. Number one point, proof of death has been suppressed. I'll read the point and then I'll tell you what I think about it. Proof of death has been suppressed. 27 children and adults, including Adam Lanza, at the school and his mother, Nancy Lanza, in her home, were dead. And they say that proof of death has been suppressed. Sorry, that's not correct. Some researchers have stated that Adam Lanza, according to the Social Security Death Index, the SSDI, died the day before, on December 13th. And so presumably, those researchers considered the SSDI as a valid source, which it is. Yet, when I went to the SSDI via my subscription on Ancestry, I found that Adam Lanza died on December 14th, which was also corroborated by three obituary and burial indexes. Now, I don't know the source of the other researchers' information, as they did not cite it. It's just an image with what appears to be a recent photo on the card. Adam's Social Security number was issued in 1992. So I question why a recent image is used in conjunction with the number that was issued in 1992. Now, the Social Security Administration, let me get a drink. Hang on. Why don't we take a five-minute break?
And I'll that sounds great. Drop. Sure. Okay, Deanna. Deanna will be right back. Sure, Deanna will be right back in 5 minutes. This is Chris Petherick, the executive editor at American Express. I'm actually doing the engineering today for normally our webs are Dave Gahari does it, but he is actually stuck in this awful, horrible weather trying to make it from Washington, D.C. up to his home in the Northeast. And so he's out there braving this snow and the ice and everything, and I was just texting with him a few minutes ago. It is terrible. The weather here is bad. We're actually not – I'm not in the office here in Washington, D.C. today. I'm actually in my office in my house running the show today and working on copy. But for those that don't know, this is the American Free Press Radio Network. AFP is a weekly newspaper. Like we talk about the Editor's Roundtable, which is was the Thursday, is now the Friday afternoon show. We are a weekly newspaper. We publish every week. We go to press on Thursdays. We will do it this week in spite of some of the you know, awful weather out here. It certainly is not going to shut us down. We publish every Thursday. We print the paper overnight, and it goes in the mail and gets delivered to everyone's home. We also have the online edition. There's a lot of great specials that we're having on the website. If you haven't checked out the website, AmericanFreePress.net, please take a moment to. There's a lot of the stories that are up there. There's also some great deals we have right now, and Dave has updated the website as well as our shop that we have, where there's 40% off currently all of AFP's published books. These are some of Victor Thorne's books, Michael Collins Piper's books that you find up there, and the great news is anything that you purchase, you get a free one-year digital subscription to AFP, and if you purchase 6 books, then you can get 6 years free of the digital subscription to AFP's newspaper. Everything that's on the website is everything that's in the newspaper is not published on the website. So if you want to get all the information that's in the newspaper every week, unfortunately, you do have to subscribe. Why do you have to subscribe? Well, again, it gets down to a lot of what Deanna's talking about today, and the fact that so much of what's out there is bunk, is garbage. People, and they do it for free. They post it anonymously. They don't care. They don't care whether they're telling you the truth or they're leading you on. So our names are on there. Our reputation are on there with this newspaper, and we have bills to pay as a result of that. So that's why, unfortunately, we do have to charge for subscriptions. We have to charge for the online subscription. We do have to charge for the print publication. So it's a great deal right now that everyone should take advantage of. It's real simple. Just go there, get a book. You get a free digital subscription to AFP so you can get all the news that's there. I'm not sure if Deanna's back here yet, but
she
was taking about a – oh, there you go. Okay. Well, was that enough time for you?
I need
a little. Oh, good. Okay. All right. Well, I was trying to give you a little bit of a break there, and I figured that – I know Dave normally runs the music, but I figured I'd tell people a little bit about AFP, the newspaper, and what we do and what sets us apart. And I was just saying that it's really, you know, piggyback on what you're talking about, in that much of what's on the internet today is posted by anonymous people, or people it's not their real name, or it's, you know, they don't care about their reputations. They're more interested in just getting some attention, so they put up garbage, they put up bunk, and they don't care about it. Whereas the newspaper, in our newspaper and on our website, we have our pictures there, our names are there, it's our reputation. We're very concerned about giving people the honest answers and the truth, and sometimes it's not necessarily popular. And I will tell you that this Sandy Hook, this is the first time in my history of doing this. I've been doing this for over a decade. In my history of doing this, I've really never seen this phenomenon. I mean, it is incredible, and I think it really is the result of the internet and the ease with which people can utilize, you know, like WordPress and some of these free services in order to just post anything on the internet and not have their name up there, so they don't really care. They don't care about it,
sure.
And they'll cherry pick pictures. They'll cherry pick things that suit their opinion. And meanwhile, they'll completely ignore a lot of the real research and the legitimate facts that are out there.
Sure. Now, excuse me. On the website, spinbola.com/sandyhook.html, you'll want to go to that website right now, because number one of the things that they said was proof of death has been suppressed. 27 children and adults, including Adam Lanza, at the school and his mother, Nancy Lanza, in her home. Well, I have found proof of death for each and every one of those people. And that proof is at my website. When a child is born, the hospital encourages them to be the parents to get a Social Security number at the time of birth. And many of the children, many of the first graders who perished at Sandy Hook, had Social Security numbers. And I found most of them in the Social Security Death Index. Now, inasmuch as the researchers said that they used the Social Security Death Index in trying to prove that Adam Lanza died the day before and therefore couldn't have been the shooter, I don't know what index they were using, because the official one that I used, and I've been using this index for years, the official index showed that Nancy Lanza was shot in her home. She was buried in New Hampshire, which is where she was apparently born. And Adam Lanza also was in the Social Security Death Index. There were also obituaries for him, burial records for him. And it's quite interesting that I've heard that another researcher say, well, a lot of these people moved in right before the event. But only two of the children had Social Security numbers assigned to them that were outside of the state of Connecticut, because they give you the date that the person obtained the record. In other words, they give like if you were born in 2006, where and many of them were. And I have this all up on that website. I give you all of the details, that I found in each of the burial records, the age, their date of birth, date of death, obituary date, residents of the time, other people who lived in the home, the date that the Social Security was, the number was issued, and it's all there for each and every person. I mean, I spent most of the weekend doing this because it does take time to go in and do all this. And anybody can do it. and I don't want you to take my word for it. You can go to Ancestry.com. They have a 14-day free trial during which you can search for each and every person that was shot and killed at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. You can, if you want to, you can go in and look for Social Security records, death records, for anybody that you know that has passed away. Just prove this for yourself. Do not ever take anybody else's word for anything. You need to do the research yourself. You need to draw your own conclusions. Like my friend said, and I quote, listen to everyone, read everything, believe nothing unless you can prove it in your own research, unquote. And so all these people, like I said, I have it all listed here, when they got their Social Security number, and the child victims, a lot of them did have a Social Security number. One of them, Daniel G. Barden, got his number in New York, but most of them got them in, one of them got it in Maryland. If you just scroll down, you'll see where, their burial record. You will see their Social Security record. There's no numbers there, but you will see the record. And if Mr. Fesser, if Dr. Fesser can use the Social Security Index, although I don't know which one he looked at, then that legitimizes our use of that same record, so they can't come back and say, yeah, but you're going to believe the government? Yes, we are, because the Social Security Death Index is a legitimate source. Now, as far as the license for Robbie Parker, I have that listed here with all of the details and whatnot, and his license expired on March 1st, 2013, so I'm assuming that if he still lives in Connecticut, that he probably renewed it, or he would have to renew it no matter where he lived if he continued to work in that field. But anyway, everybody that they say was involved that died, I found a record for every single solitary one, all of them. Okay? And that would not happen if no children died at Sandy Hook. So, let's see, let's go to number two of the 10 points. Oh, and I also did find that tax record for Ryan. Number two, emergency protocols were not followed, and there was an absence of blood outside. And on the website, it says there's no evidence of any frantic effort to save lives or to remove bodies to hospitals. Instead, the scene outside of the school looked calm and largely bloodless, with police and other personnel milling around casually and a severe shortage of dead or injured victims, unquote. One individual, who only used a first name, referred to an expired legislative act that dealt with medical waste to try to prove that the investigators had a legal responsibility to track the cleanup, presumably the blood evidence from the victims of Sandy Hook, all the way to the incinerator with names and dates. Yet, on the linked website giving the particulars of the Connecticut Medical Waste Tracking Act of 1988, it indicates that this was a two-year program that took effect on June 24, 1989, on June 21, 1991. Officials implemented it in four states, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Rhode Island, and in Puerto Rico. However, it expired on June 21st, 1991. So you cannot use that record and say they were supposed to do this because whoever, Kelly, I believe it was, said that she used she referred to that record or to that act and stated that they had to provide a tracking record all the way to the incinerator. But, hey, the act expired on June 21st, 1991. Number three, drill protocols were followed instead. Now, one such plan available on the web is Operation Closed Campus. initially from InfoWars, developed in Iowa following the guidance set forth by the Homeland Security Exercise and Evaluation Program and of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. It was published on March 21, 2011. In the 41-page document, it mentions that there have been a couple of threats over a period of 3 months because of the huge influx of poor minorities into the more affordable rural communities, presumably from two teenaged anti-immigration suspects. Apparently, they'd left some notes in the cafeteria, and one of the notes said, "If you don't get rid of them, we will." And the two suspects was Timothy Jasper and John Jackson. And this prompted the county to develop a program to address any potential assaults. And officials created a two-hour exercise scheduled at Trainer Middle Senior High School for March 26, 2011, beginning at 9 a.m. And it said, all communications, spoken or written, will begin and end with the statement, "This is an exercise," unquote. This is an exercise. There was substantial paperwork and a follow-up conference for the operation in Iowa. During the exercise, participants were not to demonstrate any aggressive behavior or carry loaded guns under any circumstances. No one was killed. Okay, in the Veterans Today article that states, according to protocol, everyone at the drill must check in. Identification badges are issued to personnel and observers, and drinking water and restrooms are available. Personnel include the director, staff, controllers, evaluators, actors, media personnel, and players. In other words, the agency employees, both in uniforms and civilian clothes. Then the statement is, this protocol, and I'm quoting, this protocol appears to have been followed at Sandy Hook, appears to have been followed, where many participants wore identification badges on lanyards, and a huge check-in sign is visible, and even porta-potties are at the ready. Does this mean that, with the electronic sign, let's start with that one. The one that said everyone must check in. It was displayed in the article, and it said that it was that the picture was taken at Sandy Hook. But how do we know that? Was there a printed protocol designed for Sandy Hook? Just because there were individuals at Sandy Hook who wore badges, does that mean that there was an exercise? Many employees are required to wear badges. The Sandy Hook had no influx of immigrants, and it did not appeal to poor immigrants. There have been no threats of any kind. The article also states that there was a school shooting drill in Bridgeport, about 19 to 20 miles from Newport, on December 14, 2012, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. It was actually an all-day class conducted by the Connecticut Department of Emergency Services and Public Protection Emergency Management and Homeland Security, entitled Planning for the Needs of Children in Disasters. The article also said, and I'm talking about the Veterans Today article, and I quote, the Sandy Hook shooting appears to have been an integrated capstone event, an exercise run by FEMA to coordinate federal, state, and local emergency response teams in the case of a mass casualty event. As such, it would have utilized actors and media partners to simulate a tragedy in order to train participants and also in order to observe the reaction of the citizenry. Well, this is suggestive. It's suggestive programming. And I think we saw the same kind of suggestive programming when you say it appears to have been and other phrases. Dan Rather, a local newscaster, used suggestive programming in Dallas, where he said that everybody could see that the president's head went violently forward, when in fact, everybody could actually see the president's head going backward. But people are more inclined, or some people are more inclined, to believe what they are told rather than what they see. It's that old problem with the lying eyes thing. And so Dan Rather, that local newscaster from Dallas, got a pay raise in a different position. He was now on national TV. And on 9/11, he was mentioning, oh, look, we've got a controlled demolition. Doesn't this seem to be a controlled demolition? And they talked about collapses, and they talked about controlled demolition, and Larry Silverstein talked about controlled demolition. We were told what to think. It didn't matter what we saw. It didn't matter about anything else. We were told what to think. And I, for one, do not like to be told what to think in any way, shape, or form. I do my own thinking, my own research. I draw my own conclusions. Okay, number, there was foreknowledge of the event. One researcher calls attention to the idea that websites were created memorializing the victims before the event occurred. A mistake that many people make is due to their lack of understanding on reconfigured domains and IP addresses. I wrote an article on September 29, 2005, where I indicated that Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush created a website to raise funds for the victims of Hurricane Katrina, which hit southeast Louisiana the morning of August 29, 2005. However, I did a search on the origination date of the site through Hoosis, and the Bush-Clinton website had a creation date of June 14, 2005. I thought, oh my gosh, they knew about that back in June, and it seemed to indicate that they had foreknowledge. And then Terry Mellinson explained how this occurs. IP addresses and domain names are two completely different things. When someone creates a domain name, he or she has to set up a DNS record for that domain to reside on an already existing IP address. An IP address is only a unique identifier for a computer that is connected to the Internet. In the case of the Bush-Clinton-Katrina Fund website, they assigned the domain to a computer, a server, that had been registered in 1988 for its particular IP address. Therefore, when I inquired through Hoosis, someone said, regarding your inquiry, the information reflected on the date of field is actually the last up for the IP address connected to that domain name. That was accurate. That IP address was assigned to a newly created domain name and was refreshed with its information on that particular date. The only real info that needs to be considered when looking at domain names is the domain's creation date, which, in the case of the Bush-Clinton thing, was September 2nd, 2005. See, I thought I caught him in a foreknowledge kind of situation, and that wasn't the case at all. I just misunderstood how these things operated. And it's very, very possible, and I've done it myself, it's very possible to devote a particular website to one activity. And then, well, for instance, I created my first website in the mid-1990s. I devoted it to an activity that I was involved with at that time. And then a few years ago, I reconfigured the entire website to reflect my current activities. It has nothing to do with the fact that anybody... IP addresses work and the way that things can be configured. So that the United Way, somebody mentioned that the United Way set up a fund way in advance, or at least 3 or 4 days in advance of the event, and it wasn't that they had foreknowledge. The fact is that they had a website set up that was devoted perhaps to some other issue, and they just reconfigured that website to use it for the Sandy Hook event. So hopefully that addresses that. Number five, there were contradictory reports about the weapons. And misreporting is very common, especially in the confusion of mass shooting. Eyewitness reports are not as valid as other evidence in any criminal court case. The Supreme Court has called eyewitness testimony notoriously unreliable. And the witness, the Innocence Project, says that eyewitness misidentification is the single greatest cause of wrongful conviction. Yet many people promote the idea that a few media interviews with people who were there is more significant than evidence reported by the police. Now, on the website, the Veterans Today website, I read, in January 2013, Connecticut State Police released a statement indicating that they had found four guns inside the school, a Bushmaster 223 caliber XM15-E2S semi-automatic rifle with high-capacity 30-round clips. High-capacity 30-round clips, that's very key. A Glock 10-millimeter handgun, which is a very good gun, and a Sig Sauer P226 9-millimeter handgun. They said they also found an Ishmash Kata 12-gauge shotgun in Lance's car, which was in the trunk, and I think all of us have seen the picture of that rifle. Now, this shotgun, it goes on the website saying, this shotgun is also shown in a video aired on the night of December 14, 2013 by NBC. An evidence collection team and a policeman find the gun in the trunk of Lance's Honda Civic. The police handles the gun without gloves and ejects the ammunition on the spot. Some have seen two long guns in the trunk in the NBC video, the 12-gauge shotgun and the Bushmaster rifle. Well, if they verified that the shotgun was not used in the crime that was committed, then I wouldn't imagine that they would have to use gloves in order to empty the ammunition. Someone by the name of, this is kind of interesting, someone by the name of Bonnie called into the Power Hour with Joyce Riley and reported that the Sandy Hook coroner, Dr. H. Wayne Carver, was spotted in Las Vegas. This Bonnie claimed she had information that she obtained from a close friend who claimed that he had just returned from Las Vegas. While he was there, he saw the coroner from Sandy Hook sitting across the table from him. He claims that he said to Carver, and I quote, "You know, this is pretty fishy about Sandy Hook, and it's starting to look like a hoax." And the doctor said, and I quote, "It was a hoax." Now, that's what this person said who claimed that he saw Carver in Las Vegas. I guess that's like seeing Elvis or something. But and so all kinds of things. Well, who is Bonnie? Who is Bonnie? Who are all these people? Who is Kelly? How are they? What information do they have that could be so life-shattering and so significant that all of us are supposed to accept it and believe it and think, oh, gosh, okay, we just believe everything that we see on the Internet or that we hear? I don't think so. Now, alleged shooter Adam Lanza used this Bushmaster AR-15 assault rifle as his primary weapon. That's a really big gun. And it does, he had the, it has, it's an automatic with high-capacity 30-round clips. If a group of children are hovered together, I think you could do a lot of damage. I think you could.
Deanna, this is Chris. This is Chris. I just wanted to chime in real quick. Yeah, semi-automatic and not automatic, okay, which is a difference. But even still, I have, you know, anyone who has small children as a parent and who's ever been to an elementary school, you know, the idea of six-year-old children in a classroom in one of these brick or stone buildings, you know, I mean, it's absolutely crazy and ridiculous that people think that you wouldn't be able to do a considerable amount of damage very quickly with a rifle like that. You know, I mean, it's The kids are just going to sit. It's unbelievable. And I'm shocked to see that people would have that. Yeah, I think it was we were reading something the other day with Jim Fetzer was claiming that, oh, yeah, that's a 90% accuracy. That's, you know, and snipers envy that and everything. Well, they're not, you know, this isn't a combat situation. This is little kids in a school, you know, and to be crass, it's like fish in a barrel. I mean, they can't go anywhere. So it's you know, I agree with you 100% there about that, and it's absolutely ridiculous the claims made about those about that particular firearm.
You know, when I was going through, I'm sorry, I get kind of emotional sometimes. When I was going through the death records.
Yeah.
I did this over the weekend, and I saw the pictures. The pictures weren't associated with the death records. I found a site that had all of the kids listed. I think they were missing one child. But as I was going through these death records and just kind of getting a feel for them, they were 6 and 7 year olds, and going through the burial records and the Social Security death records, it just hit me, just what a terrible thing happened. And it is absolutely the most egregious thing that I can imagine that somebody would say to parents or to suggest to that these parents were somehow acting and that their child was not dead. I just can't imagine a worse thing to do to parents, to grieving parents who have lost their children, to accuse them of just acting. It's just unbelievable to me.
Yeah, it's difficult, and people have been extremely callous about this, and the claims made about this are absolutely ridiculous and outlandish, and the claims made about caskets, you know, open caskets versus non-open caskets, why didn't they release the photographs, you know, the crime scene photographs, this type of ridiculous, this nonsense that people are talking about. So I understand exactly where you're coming from there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I do have some links on my website. That's spingola.com/sandyhook.html. And you can see photos. I've got a link there where you can see the photos. And of course they redacted the scene. Of course they redacted it. Who would want to see little children shot up? Of course they're going to redact it.
Yeah.
And I've got all these reports. I've got a lot of files there and places where you can look at all the files. You can see the pictures of the school. And I looked at all these photos. I mean, there's hundreds of photos that people can look at. And to say that they redacted it because they're trying to conceal something. Yeah, they're trying to conceal dead children, people. That's what they're trying to conceal. I get really emotional. Sorry.
No, I understand. You know, a number of these claims. There was another claim associated with that where the report that just came out of Sandy Hook, the official report, you know, where much of the material in there was redacted, the names of the children, the autopsy pictures, this type of thing, and people were even criticizing that, making these crazy claims that, you know, never in history when they've released these reports have they ever gone to this length to redact this much material. Well, I don't believe that's true because we've done in the past. I remember the case of in Oklahoma, this pedophile ring that was going on in Oklahoma, that there were a lot of claims about some of these the satanic rituals and things like that involved in it, and John DeCamp had written a book about that some years ago, and much of the material in there was never released because it involved children, and for that very same reason, you know, so there is a history of this. And that is that John DeCamp is very well known in our, again, I use that term universe, in our universe as a researcher, putting together the book, and that then what he did on the Oklahoma cover-up involved with this child sex ring that went on there. So people, you know, I don't know whether listeners now would be aware of it, but anybody who's been around and been involved in this you know, and been around the days of the spotlight and early AFP, and John DeCamp's name has come up. In fact, you can look up Oklahoma cover-up, and there's a big big documentary that was done on John DeCamp. So that information is out there. But that was much of that was redacted as well. So there is plenty of past history and proof of the fact that local officials and police go to tremendous strides to try to prevent, keep the identity and these gruesome, horrific crime scene photographs involving children to keep them out of the public's hands.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. Number six, Adam, stay on with me, Chris. I enjoy talking with you.
Oh, sure, Adam Lanza, I will, yeah.
Adam Lanza, number six, Adam Lanza cannot have done the shooting. Alleged shooter Adam Lanza, he used an assault rifle, and people say, oh, no, he didn't weigh enough, he couldn't have carried that rifle in, he couldn't have carried the other guns in, he didn't have any, he was a novice, he couldn't have shot that, he couldn't have done all this. Baloney. And Mike Powers was on Joyce Riley's program on January 16, 2013, just over a month, 2 days over a month, saying that logistically he could not have carried off the shooting. However, Nancy Lanza took both of her boys to the shooting range a lot, regularly. By the time that Adam Lanza was 9 years old, he had been to the shooting range. He knew how to use a gun. He was not a novice. He had done this. He had shot before. He was used to having guns around. So he knew what he was doing. He knew how to use a gun. But Mike Powers, who the heck is Mike Powers? Supposedly, he's a professional military investigator and ballistic expert. And he observed that a young man of slight build could not have carried all these heavy, bulky weapons and ammunition on his person. Well, when I was in China, people are very slight over there. They're short, very small. You would not believe what those people can carry. You cannot tell by looking at a person how strong they are. I saw people probably that weighed the same as Adam Lanza picking up rocks that probably weighed 50 pounds. So we can't make that assumption that somebody can't do something when, in fact, he did this. 20 dead children.
I have
he
a,
did this.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I have a Mini 14, Deanna, which is which is very similar to an AR-15. It's a Mini 14. I have the ranch version, which has a beautiful wood stock on it. It's a gorgeous gun, and it fires a 223 round like the AR-15 does as well. It has a five. I don't need to get into the specifics of it, but when I put in a small clip on it, it looks like a really nice hunting rifle. When I put on the bigger banana clip on it, it looks like an assault rifle that's there. But the point I'm making here is that has absolutely zero kickback on it whatsoever, and it is a firearm that anybody can use. It's easy to carry, and it is intended for even smaller people to be able to use that and fire that. So I have absolutely no doubt that even somebody of Adam Lanza's slight build would be able to use that gun and do considerable damage with that.
Exactly, and I asked the teachers of a recent NRA class I took, I asked him about it, and he said, oh, absolutely. Absolutely, he could have done that.
Yeah, but, sure. Yeah.
So everybody should do their own research. Don't accept all this stuff. Okay. Number seven, key participants displayed inappropriate behavior. Inappropriate according to who? We cannot determine how people are going to act in any given situation, whether somebody is going to say something or do something, or, for instance, with Wayne Carver, I saw the video, and if I had not, if there hadn't been a little text message right above saying, look at him giggle or look at him grin, I wouldn't have noticed that. I wouldn't have noticed him doing any of those things unless somebody suggested that was what he was doing. We do not have the right to judge what is in a person's heart. We do not have the right to judge what they're thinking, how they're feeling, how they're reacting, how they're responding, because we all respond in different ways. I've been to a lot of funerals where where there's been laughter. At, you know, as you gather out in the lobby and whatnot, people are remembering the good times that they had with the deceased, and they're telling funny stories. Yes, there is laughter at funerals, and people can laugh, or I mean, you cannot judge or how they react. And apparently, and this they called attention to this in the article at Veterans Today, that Don Hochsprung, in Embarrassing Fiction, the Newtown Bee reported on 14 December 2013 that Don Hochsprung, the Sandy Hook school principal, told the paper that a masked man had entered the school with a rifle and started shooting multiple shots, more than she could count, and went on and on and on. And apparently, the Newtown Bee misreported. They were not talking to Don Hochsprung because she was dead. And they don't tell you that the Newtown Bee rescinded that article, which corroborates the fact that there's a lot of false reporting. But the newspaper immediately corrected that error, and yet they don't mention that. They just let you think that, oh, well, she was killed, and yet here she's giving an interview. Well, no, she didn't give an interview. As I say, they corrected that. Number eight, photos at the scene. And if photos looking staged or fake, or victims look staged or fake. Well, first they talk about the fact that nobody allowed anybody to see the bodies, and now they're saying that the victims look staged. Okay, what is it? Either you didn't see them, or they look staged. Which you're going to choose? I don't know. It's kind of different. The crime scene was completely destroyed. No, the school was destroyed. The crime scene the investigators worked the crime scene, did their investigation. The crime scene was not completely destroyed. The school was destroyed, and of course they did earn some money. They did get some money to build another school after the destruction. Number 10, deceased children sang at the Super Bowl. Seriously. If people were going to try to pull off a conspiracy, would they really allow allegedly deceased children to sing at the Super Bowl? I mean, that's ridiculous. And some people questioned the authenticity of a Parker family photo, suggesting that someone photoshopped Emily into the family portrait. That might be true and could be significant if the photo was taken after the shooting, but there is no proof of that. It is merely a family portrait in which one of the children were missing, and that's not uncommon. People do that. Sometimes that happens. Family members said that the girl, and people say, well, we saw the president, we saw President Obama, and he had Emily on his lap, and she was wearing the same dress that she wore in the family photo. And as I mentioned before, some children, you see them all the time, some little girls, three little girls, may have the same outfit. Or sometimes an older sibling will pass her clothes down to a younger sibling. And family members said that the girl seen with Obama was Emily's younger sister, Madeline. If the government was trying to convince the public that 20 children had been shot, it would be ludicrous if any of those children were then seen in public, especially at the Super Bowl, or photographed with Obama. The Sandy Hook truthers refused to accept any information from the media. The truth about Sandy Hook will come out in the wash, of course, as the saying goes. It would be very unwise if we were to accept everything that the media reports, but it is just as foolish to claim that there's a massive conspiracy just because of a picture of a little girl posing with Obama, or because the parents of dead children don't seem as despondent as they should be in front of the cameras. To say that this is a giant conspiracy, you'd have to have what's the motive people have to have motive. And I think, personally, that given the number of school shootings, and you can go to the website Wikipedia, and I don't necessarily believe everything that's on Wikipedia. You have to pick and choose. That's what research is, picking and choosing. And everybody has a bias, and everybody's going to pick the things that accommodate their bias, that accommodate their agenda. But if you go to Wikipedia, just Google or search for list of school shootings, and you will find that the school shootings increased dramatically when they started creating all of these psychiatric drugs. And when they can put little children 12 months on antipsychotic drugs, I mean, it's just going to do something to your mind. It really does. It does a lot of terrible, terrible things. And so we have to look at all of the factors in this. We have to look at everything that happened. We do have to do our own research. We have to look at all the records, not just the ones that you favor. Don't go to the websites of your favorite guru and try and get all the information there. Do your own darn research. It's important that you do. And if you go to Ancestry.com, you do not have to have a subscription. You can get the 14-day free trial, and you can find every single one of these children. You can find Nancy Lanza, Adam Lanza. You can find Rachel D. Avino, a teacher's aide. You will find Don Huxbrun, the principal. You will find Anne Marie Murphy. I think that her boyfriend was just about to propose to her. She was a teacher's aide. You will find Lauren Rousseau, who is a teacher. You will find Mary Sherlach, who is a school psychologist. You will find Vivian Lee Soto, who is a teacher. You will find first grade students, Charlotte Bacon. You'll find her Social Security Death Index number. You'll find Daniel Barden, Olivia Engel, Josephine Gay, Dylan Hockley, Madeline Sui, Catherine Hubbard, Chase Kowalski, Jesse Lewis, Anna Marquez Green, James Mattioli, Grace McDonald, Emily Alice Parker, Jack Pinto Posner, Caroline Previti, Jessica Rescos, AVL Richmond, Benjamin Wheeler, and Allison Wyatt. All dead. All in the Social Security Death Index, an official file of the Social Security Administration. I'm very grateful for you joining me today. I really haven't been a Sandy Hook researcher. I've been doing a lot of other projects in the past year. I've watched a few of the things, had a lot of questions, and decided for myself that I would look into this. And there was a time when I first looked at the first video, when I looked at Robbie Parker, I thought, well, given his religion and given his nervousness, to me it didn't seem like he was an actor. It seemed like he was a distressed father that had just lost his six-year-old daughter. And that's the way that it appeared to me. And I saw some other videos. I've seen videos where they brought in Agenda 21, and I think, what's that got to do with it? where the goat traipsing off to, in some other direction, talking about, oh, there's a bunch of Satanists there. I don't think that a town of 30,000, that every person in that town is going to cover up such a travesty. I've lived in a town where there were 30,000 people, and I just don't think it would happen. And you also have to consider all of the aunts, uncles, grandparents of these children, the husbands of the adults, the children of the adults. You have to consider all of that, not just some crazy conspiracy theories. And you have to figure out what the heck is going on. Why would anybody do this unless there was an agenda, unless there was an objective to fracture the truth movement? If we're all in the same boat, I think it's time that we all rowed together. And if you're not part of finding the truth, then get the heck out. Take your divisiveness somewhere else. Take your nonsensical conspiracy theories somewhere else. The truth movement should be about truth, not about seeing who can out somebody else, not about having some program where you vilify somebody that has been producing the kind of work that Michael Collins Piper has produced for his entire life. What a low down act. To get on, to have a program and say, oh yeah, Michael backed out when he was suffering, when he has a heart situation that is very critical. That is about as low down as you can get. And it was commentary on those people that did it, not commentary on Mike. Mike would have been there, and he would have done well. And the fact that Fetzer and Friend vilified Mike in his absence is just, it's commentary on them. Shame on them. Well, I think I'm going to cut the program short today. Thank you so much for joining me. Please look at spingola.com/sandyhook.html. Look at the information there. Do your own research. And think about these parents who have lost their children. They are dead. They were killed. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Deanna, thank you for doing this today. And I know it was difficult to be able to go through all this. And it's difficult to go through all the, to do all this research, to be able to put this together. Because when you do, you really start seeing the faces and you start seeing these are real people. And it makes it extra hard to be able to put all that together. And then to be able to combat this, a lot of this nonsense that is out there. And it's been, again, I want to reiterate, there's been tremendous pressure on us to publicize some of these wackier conspiracy theories that are out there, and I'm pretty proud of the fact that we did stick to our guns and that we didn't do that and we didn't get dragged into this. And it is about time that more of us come out and say that this is not who we are and this isn't what we do, and we are more interested in getting to the truth and in not just publicizing some outlandish conspiracy theories that where there's no basis in fact. So thank you again for doing this show. And on Thursday night, for anyone who's listening, there is going to be a debate between Dr. James Fetzer and Keith Johnson, who is one of our writers. He's got extensive background in law enforcement, private detective, and he's done a considerable amount of research as well on this issue, and he has a lot to offer to this debate and provide it. And they're going to look very closely at a lot of the theories that have been put out there, some of them put out by Dr. James Fetzer, and discuss these in an open environment for 2 hours. And so we encourage everybody to come in and listen, and then hopefully that people will realize what's out there and take your advice, Deanna, and do their own research and look into this and find out for themselves that these people are real, that this happens, and we may not have all the answers, but we do have a lot of the answers, and most of them don't involve outlandish, crazy conspiracy theories about what happened and what may have happened based on people's opinions. Well, thanks a lot, Deanna, and thanks, listeners, and everybody else. And please go to spingola.com/sandyhook.html. Is that correct? Is that the site?
Yes.
Yes, that's the site. Good. Yeah, we'll go ahead and link to that as well on our homepage too, so people can see that. Our homepage is AmericanFreePress.net. We're a weekly newspaper, and anybody interested in subscribing, there's information on there on the website, or you can go ahead and call us toll-free, 888-699-NEWS, 888-699-6397, and we have all kinds of great deals for subscribing. Well, thanks again, Deanna, and we'll go ahead and wrap it up for the day. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you so much. You too. Bye-bye, Chris. Bye-bye, listeners. Thank you.